This program is intended for a print-paired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Material is selected with the interests of its audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Welcome to Backyard Bookshelf, a production of Audio Journal, bringing you fiction, nonfiction, and other readings with a local connection. I'm Naomi, and today I will be reading from A Place for Us by Nicholas Gage. We are resuming Chapter 16. I immediately liked Peter's enthusiasm and dedication. He explained that the Weekly Chronicle was basically a family operation. He was the publisher and chief ad salesman. His wife and sister ran the business side of things, and his brother-in-law, an editor of a Rhode Island newspaper, wrote the Chronicle's articles and editorials in his spare time. I was hired to come in after school on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays to help with the writing, and on Thursdays, I would go with Peter to the printer to oversee production. For this, I would receive $1 an hour, or about $15 a week, before I subtracted the cost of subway tokens. The job at the Chronicle gave me an opportunity to practice real journalism and write about Greece, but I still wasn't making enough to eat on a regular basis. So I went to the university's placement service and found a second job working Saturdays and Sundays at the counter of a Howard Johnson's in Cambridge. I could get there by walking across the bridge over the Charles River, so I saved the cost of public transportation. As winter erased the fiery palette of fall, turning Boston into a charcoal drawing, the rowing teams disappeared from the Charles and my resolution began to wear thin. It seemed that I was always hurrying through the bitter cold toward one job or another, fighting the wind as I crossed the bridge towards Cambridge, or emerging from the MTA station to enter the dark offices of the Hellenic Chronicle. Often I would find myself staring at the picture of my nephews and niece, imagining what was happening on Chandler Street. Now Glycerius clearing the table, and Jimmy Tsouras is arriving with his cigar to sit and talk politics with Father, I'd think. Olga's nearly got the babies to bed, and then she'll come downstairs and bring Koulourakia to go with the coffee. My longing for home was eroding the energy I needed to get through each week, but there was no way I could go back to visit Worcester while spending every Saturday and Sunday behind the counter at Howard Johnson's. On Saturdays, I worked there from 3 o'clock until 11:30, and then I had to be back by 8 a.m. on Sunday to work until 4:30 in the afternoon. Sundays were the worst because it seemed that everyone in Cambridge went out for a walk in the afternoon, then stopped at Howard Johnson's to order a snack. One day, in the cold heart of winter, I was frantically serving the counter, running back and forth and thinking wistfully about the Sunday afternoon scene on Chandler Street, my father sitting in the parlor with his belt loosened after the big Sunday meal, passing the string of amber worry beads through his fingers as the grandchildren played at his feet. Suddenly, I heard a sound out of my fantasy, the rhythmic click-click of the kumbolii, and I looked up, startled to see my father sitting at the end of the counter, watching me intently and fingering his beads over a cup of coffee. It was so busy we couldn't do more than smile at each other as I rushed past, but he sat there all afternoon watching me work until my shift was over. When I was finished, he drove me in his old green Plymouth back across the river to my room. "I brought you some Kooluria," he said. "I thought I'd take your dirty laundry home to clean. Anyway, I wanted to see how you're getting on." I took the demi-tasse cups and the briquette down the hall to the kitchen to make us Greek coffee, then brought back the foaming cups, handing him one as he sat on the wooden chair. Father looked around the room, which seemed to grow smaller and tawdrier under his gaze, and neither of us said anything. Then he spoke. "When I first came to Worcester, 17 years old," he said, "I went with some other greenhorns over to Reed and Prince, trying to get work. It was a day like this, below zero, and we stood outside the gates and waited while the foreman picked workers out of the crowd. First he picked the Scandinavians, the Swedes and the Finns and the Danes. Then he picked the Germans and the Irish. Then he looked at the rest of us standing there with our collars up and our hands in our pockets, and he said, 'You greasers can go on home.' I couldn't understand all his words, but I figured greasers, grease. And it was the same thing. So he went away, but we stood there longer, thinking maybe he would need a couple more men or feel bad seeing us standing outside in the cold. We Greeks were very persistent in those days, had to be. After a while, the foreman came out again, up to the gate, carrying a bucket of water, and he said, 'Didn't I tell you to leave?' He threw the freezing water right at us. It was like being hit in the face with an axe. He stopped speaking, and we both heard a rattling sound, his coffee cup shaking against the saucer as he held it. Carefully, he put the untouched coffee on the table beside the bed. 'That's all I could think of when I saw you working today, running like that behind the counter,' he continued. 'I always thought, my son, he won't have to live like I lived, scrambling for work in order to eat. Now I don't know. My only son, and what have I ever done to help you?'" He dug into his pockets and took out every crumpled bill he could find, $63 in all, and he placed them next to the coffee cup. Then he picked up my bag of dirty laundry without another word and left, walking down the hall with that same old man's gait that I first noticed on the day I left for college. My first impulse was to go after him, because I could see how much pain he felt at being unable to help me after years of saying how important it was for me to get an education. His shame and disappointment were so palpable that I wanted to reassure him that it didn't matter, but a great weariness held me back. The truth was, it did matter. I couldn't help wishing he had managed his life better, so that I wouldn't have to work so hard now to pay for college. Whatever I said to comfort him, Father would know I was lying. As his footsteps faded away, my eyes fell on the pile of money on my bedside table, and I realized that although he could never give me much, he always gave me all he could, just like now. I was sorry I hadn't managed to thank him, but I knew he had left his money to make me feel better, not worse. Suddenly, I knew what I'd do with the windfall. I had been longing to see some of the touring Broadway companies performing in Boston, especially Henry Fonda in Silent Night, Lonely Night by Robert Anderson at the Colonial Theater. Now, I rashly decided, I was going to buy myself a ticket. The thought of actually seeing a first-run play energized me, and I walked all the way down Commonwealth Avenue with my coat collar turned up over my ears until I reached the theater just off the Boston Common. I bought a single ticket in the balcony for $4.50. Then I realized there were still 2 hours until curtain time. I strolled across the public garden and caught sight of the Ritz-Carlton. I still had over $58 left, so I decided to splurge and have dinner at the Ritz. That evening, I discovered the Ritz's famous lobster and whiskey sauce while sitting in solitary splendor beneath the cobalt blue and crystal chandeliers, sipping a glass of white wine and exchanging companionable smiles with the Boston Brahmins around me. After coffee, feeling totally satiated for the first time since I left Worcester, I walked around the corner of the garden and stopped at Peretti's on Park Square to choose a good Havana cigar. Peter Agris had introduced me to the habit by rewarding me with one every time we put the Hellenic Chronicle to bed. Puffing on my Partagas, I continued on to the Colonial Theater, reserving half the cigar for later. I settled in to watch Henry Fonda with the eye of a seasoned theater critic, imagining myself in the same league as Elliot Norton, the Eminence Grice of the Boston Record American. I would review this production for the BU News, I decided, and bestow on Fonda some neatly phrased praise for his deceptively casual style of acting. After the performance, I left the theater, inhaling the icy night air and surveying the Boston Common, white and silver in the moonlight. The world seemed a much lovelier place than it had that morning when I had been struggling over the Charles River toward the Howard Johnsons. Relighting my cigar, I strolled back towards Boston University in my solitary room, feeling as prosperous as Press Lord William Randolph Hearst, the subject of my all-time favorite film, Citizen Kane. My one Lucullian night of luxury had cost me $15.25, $4.50 for the theater ticket, $9.50 for dinner at the Ritz, and $1.25 for the cigar. But it had revived my spirits enough to keep me going for weeks. I resolved that I would set aside my father's gift and any Howard Johnson tips I could hoard, and once every month I would treat myself to this kind of evening. The monthly outings became my salvation. Naturally, I couldn't afford to take a date, but just knowing that one evening out of 30, I could put on my shiny blue suit, sit in a real theater, and watch the world's finest actors perform in first-run plays after dining on the Ritz's ineffable lobster and whiskey sauce gave me this strength to spend the other 29 days working, studying, and dining on tomato soup and leftover Howard Johnson's hamburgers. Christmas break was my chance to return to Worcester and my family at last. The tumult of my niece and nephews at 369 Chandler Street, the aromas of spinach pie, and the buttery Greek Christmas cookies were as sweet as my homesick fantasies had painted them. But once I had been home for a few days, I realized that financially, my family was doing even worse than before. Dina was the most ambitious and the most overburdened of my sister's husbands. His and oldest daughter, Eleni, named for my mother, had been born in 1958. Their fourth child and the fourth granddaughter. In order to feed his family and help support his siblings and parents back in Greece, Dino was now working three jobs and making himself sick with exhaustion and stress. From 8 a.m. to 4 p.m, he worked at my father's old job at Kresge's lunch counter, sneaking out 15 minutes early to get to his next job, cooking from 4 to midnight at a nightclub restaurant called Bronzo's. And on Sundays, Dino worked from 11 a.m. to midnight at Adam's Steakhouse, owned by a fellow Greek. Olga and Dina hadn't planned to have so many children so fast, but Dina adored his brood. One day, when he walked into Worcester's Greek grocery store, the Olympia on Main Street, holding two toddlers by the hand, an old Greek bachelor asked him, "Those both yours?" "These and two more at home," Dino replied proudly. The old man rolled his eyes and said to the patrons of the store, "Well, what else do poor people have to do but make babies?" Dino flushed scarlet, grabbed the man by the throat, and nearly lifted him off the floor. "I have a wife, children, a home, and a good name," he shouted. "What do you have after 40 years in America, you old shit?" But despite his protestations that he was satisfied, Dino still dreamed of making a fortune. As he worked around the clock in other people's restaurants, he talked of opening a place of his own. My father, however, like all men who were young during the Depression, insisted it was foolhardy to give up the good jobs he had for a risky venture. Angelo and Procopi were having an even harder time than Dino supporting their families because of the sagging economy in Worcester. After picking apples, Angelo had obtained a low-level job at Bay State Abrasives, where Procopi was working two consecutive shifts and worrying about the health of his wife. In the 2 years after her first baby was born, Glykeria suffered two miscarriages. Dr. Seidenberg treated her both times and advised, "You should wait a while, build up your strength, and then try again." But Procopi was impatient. Glykeria decided to take her problem to a higher authority. She had originally agreed to her father-in-law's assistance in a letter from Greece that she name the next baby Vasily, but after two miscarriages, she concluded the name was bad luck. She went to church and invoked the aid of our region's patron saint, famous for the miracles accompanied by his mummified corpse in Corfu. "Dear Saint Spiridon," Glykeria prayed, kneeling before this icon, "if you help me have a baby, I'll name it Spiridon, or Spiridula if it's a girl, and I'll light candles to you every Sunday." She returned home feeling better, but when I came back from college that first Christmas vacation, I was shocked at how pale and exhausted she was. Despite my family's worries, they all pampered and praised me, and when I went back to Boston, I felt my spiritual batteries recharged. Until I left Worcester, I hadn't understood how much of an advantage my family's love and emotional support gave me, a strength and self-confidence that many of my American classmates lacked. While I spent my days at school longing to be home, I was amazed at how many classmates hated returning to their parents and seized on any excuse to postpone it. Whenever classes were suspended for the pre-exam week of the cramming, I took the opportunity to go back to Worcester, but I still did well enough in my courses so that in June my $500 BU scholarship was renewed. Another financial break was my appointment as city editor of the BU News for the next year, succeeding Jim Savage, who became executive editor. The post would pay half my tuition, which was now $1,150, so I could give up the weekend job at Howard Johnson's and still get by. This meant that on weekends, I could hitchhike back to Worcester and see my family more often. My run of luck faltered when I went back to the Worcester Gazette that spring to begin the reporter's job that the city editor had promised. My nemesis was the executive editor, who told me that no matter what Donahue said, I would have to start by serving in a suburban bureau before I could work on the metropolitan staff. He offered me a job in far-off Gardner, but I protested that I would need a car to get there every day, and I didn't have one. "Then buy one," he said. But I can't afford a car, I explained. I can barely afford to pay for college as it is. Well, then have your father put the down payment on a car and you pay him off from your salary, he replied. My father can't afford to buy a car any more than I can, I answered irritably. He's sick and out of work. The editor shrugged. Rules were rules, he said. There was no way he could let me skip to the city staff without serving my apprenticeship in the suburbs, no matter how much Steve Donahue wanted me. I called up Gregory Bocas in Philadelphia and asked if he could use me to manage his Ocean City restaurant again. He agreed and offered me even more than I'd made 2 years before, $100 a week. That summer of 1960, while a young senator from Massachusetts waged a new kind of media-wise election campaign against Richard Nixon, I enjoyed 3 months on the boardwalk that were even better than those in 1958. Now I was as old as the waitresses I managed, and my social life was even more stimulating than it had been when I was a high school boy. The sun, the surf, and the rock and roll at Summers Point seemed better too, probably because that summer was the end of an era. After 3 months of hedonism in Ocean City, I had almost $1,000 saved. The only flaw was that I had been cheated of the chance to spend time with my family, and now I had to return to the lonely grind of college. I couldn't even go home on weekends because Glykeria, who had become pregnant again, was confined to bed by her doctor, and her husband asked me not to visit so she wouldn't insist on getting up to cook for me. Being forced to stay in Boston, concentrating on my studies and the newspaper, proved to be my advantage. As city editor of the BU News, I learned a lesson from the editor-in-chief, Joel Ellman, that would ultimately be more useful to me than anything I learned in the classroom. Joel was an original, a former high school dropout, trapeze artist, and battery commander in the Air Force, who was now an honor student of Slavic literature. He insisted that all of us on the staff look for a fresh perspective on every story and never take anything for granted. The first time I saw Joel's method at work was when he assigned a series on the parking violations given to BU students by the Boston police. Maybe the police are being unfair. Are they as tough on VIPs and public officials? Joel asked the staff. Let's see if we can find out. We staked out expensive downtown hotels, civic buildings, and the state house, and found dozens of public officials flagrantly ignoring parking rules while the police left them unmolested. At the climax of our coverage, the BU News roving photographer snapped the car of a registrar of motor vehicles, triple parked in a no parking zone outside a luxury hotel. Our story and pictures were picked up by the Boston newspapers, and the registrar issued a formal protest. But in the end, he was forced out of office. Meanwhile, the police patrolling the periphery of the campus became more even-handed with students. And I learned the value of Joel's warning. Take nothing for granted. It was my first lesson in investigative reporting. As city editor, I also inaugurated a page devoted to dissenting opinions and tried to get a variety of students and faculty to write on both sides of current issues. One of the most difficult assignments was the presidential election of 1960. I couldn't find anyone on campus willing to write an essay supporting Richard Nixon, since the students and faculty were all for John F. Kennedy. I finally assigned a bright political science student to pretend he was pro-Nixon and write in his defense. When Kennedy won by the smallest plurality of the century, I learned never to consider Massachusetts college voters a microcosm of the country. Kennedy's inaugural speech in January 1961 was the finest speech I had ever heard, as he appealed to a new generation of Americans to help him light our country. And the glow from that fire can truly light the world. Perhaps even more than my classmates, I considered Kennedy to be my candidate. Since I had come to America, Kennedy had been the first presidential challenger from Massachusetts, and as an Irish Catholic, he was an outsider in this Yankee stronghold, just as we Greeks were. My sophomore year came to a close, and I learned that the BU News staff had recommended me for the post of editor-in-chief, although this position traditionally went to a senior, and that the administration had approved their recommendation. I would be editor during my junior year, and the position carried with it payment for full tuition. The night of the official announcement, the staff of the News retired to the nearby dugout bar to celebrate. After a few congratulatory toasts, I decided to call my father from the lounge and collected enough change to pay the toll to Worcester. When he first heard my voice, he thought something was wrong, but I reassured him. "It's good news, great news, in fact," I shouted. "I'm the new editor of the school paper next year." "This must be an important honor at your college, from the way you sound," he replied. "It's the first time the position will be held by a junior," I boasted. "Ah, it's a position as well as an honor," he said. "Yeah, of course. I'll have more than 40 people under me," I told him, "and it pays full tuition. I'll be able to make it through another year." "That's wonderful news. I'm proud of you," he responded somewhat uncertainly. "Are you sure it won't be too hard for you, this being editor?" "Not at all," I assured him. "I know exactly how I want to change the paper, and I have a good staff." "You have the education you know best," he said. "But tell me something so I can explain to your sisters. What does an editor do?" I told him as best I could, and he listened attentively, never reluctant to ask for more explanation when he didn't understand something. "Yes, now I see," he said finally. "I'll tell your sisters." As I returned to my friends, I found myself wondering something apprehensively, how much my education and the new opportunities it brought me would create a gulf between my life and my family's. That spring, I returned to the Evening Gazette, and with the news that I was the first junior at BU to be chosen editor-in-chief. I managed to make the Gazette's executive editor relent and give me a job on the city staff, even though I hadn't served in the suburbs. This meant that I could live at home at last. When I reported to the Gazette, I made a friend, another reporter, who also began work that day. Dave Mulholland, a tall, lanky graduate of Tufts, with a blonde crew cut, spectacles, and protruding ears. I soon discovered that Dave burned with the kind of social consciousness endemic among my generation. When President Kennedy established the Peace Corps on March 1, 1961, it was as if he had issued a personal summons to Dave, who immediately applied to join the new Volunteer Army for Peace, and was just marking time at the Gazette until he received word. In July, Dave learned that he had been accepted. He couldn't wait to get started, but I tried to temper his idealism. "Since I come from one of those undeveloped countries you're going to save," I said to him one day over lunch, "I think I should warn you what you're going to find. People will look at you with suspicion. Why does some rich blonde American college boy think he can tell me how to cultivate my field or raise my children? Their governments are crawling with corruption, nepotism, and political feuds. You're going to get frustrated, angry, and discouraged at the way the people you're trying to help will resist being saved. So what should we do? Let them live in misery and die of malnutrition?" Dave replied evenly. By the time he left for the training program, promising to keep in touch through letters, I was so distracted by problems at home that I could only wish him good luck. Glyceria was still in bed trying to bring her pregnancy to full term, and Dino feared he was dying. Dino had always avoided eating at home because he could survive on the leftovers from the three restaurants where he worked, thus leaving more food for his children. But for some months he had been suffering agonizing stomach pains and vomiting whenever he ate. Dr. Seidenberg diagnosed it as appendicitis and operated on him. But as soon as Dino got back to work, the same symptoms began again. Finally, he concluded that he must have stomach cancer. One day, Dino confided his fears to Olga, saying, "When I die, I want you to have your father come up here to the third floor to live and take care of the kids. You're going to have to go out and find a job somewhere. You have to stay calm and strong, because if you fall apart, our children are going to end up living on the street." Olga, never noted for her composure, instantly became hysterical, screaming, wailing, and keening loudly enough to rouse the whole neighborhood. We all learned the terrible news. Dino had the bad sickness. Greeks react to illness within the family in a manner that might seem peculiar to Westerners. First, they leap to the worst possible conclusion. A cold is diagnosed as pneumonia. A rash is probably leprosy. Therefore, Dino never doubted that he had cancer eating away at his belly. Already thin, he was now haggard, with black hollows under his eyes. As soon as Greeks diagnose the illness that threatens their home, they begin fixing blame. "No wonder he's dying. Your children never stop making noise so their father can sleep," Glyceria volunteered from her own sickbed. "It's not the children. It's his accursed relatives, draining him of strength and money like vampires," father retorted, his voice drowning out Glyceria's. We all pitched in with our own suggestions as to who was responsible for causing Dino's cancer. But whenever an outsider approached, we all drew together into a wall of silence and denial. For the final reaction Greeks have to illness is to deny to the outside world that there's any sickness at all. Serious illness is a shameful secret, and we all insisted that absolutely nothing was wrong with Dino. Glyceria, however, with her natural gift for spreading news, couldn't help whispering to a cousin that Dino was on the verge of death from the bad sickness, but no one must know. Within days, the entire congregation of St. Spiridon's was planning Dino's wake. The invalid himself, however, decided to consult another doctor, who concluded that Dino was only suffering from a nervous stomach caused by too many jobs and responsibilities. Dino decided to take the doctor's advice and quit all of his jobs except the one at Bronzo's. Our other medical crisis, Glyceria's pregnancy, also ended happily when she gave birth to a second son, dutifully named Spiridon, for the saint who had brought about this miracle. Little Spiro weighed 9 pounds 8 ounces and was born at 10 a.m. on August 4, 1961. I had put the lessons I had learned from Joel Ellman to work that summer as a reporter on the Gazette and tried to approach each assignment from a fresh perspective. When the summer was over, Steve Donahue told me I'd done some good stories and he hoped I would come back to the Gazette full-time when I finished at BU. Steve's words gave me a sudden inspiration. I said that I might be able to work full-time for him even before I graduated. If I fulfilled the main requirements of my journalism program in my junior year, then in my senior year I could choose classes that met in the afternoon. That way I could work full-time for the Gazette, because a staff reporter's hours went from 7:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. If I had a car, I could leave a little early and drive to Boston in time for 2 o'clock classes. Steve agreed to the plan and said he would pay me $85 a week. Enough, I figured, to finance my last year's tuition and the payments on the used car. After all, I would be living at home without the cost of room and board. I returned to BU and moved into a real apartment with kitchen and bathroom, which I shared with a friend from the paper. As a junior, I began the 2-year journalism program, but my experience at the BU News and the Hellenic Chronicle and the Worcester Gazette had already made subjects like copy editing, reporting, and feature writing second nature to me. So I breezed through the required courses, scarcely having to study. I spent far more time at the BU News offices in the basement of a university office building than I did in my own apartment, and the staff became like my family. In a university as large as BU, everyone needs some sort of group for friendship and mutual support, and the news staff became inseparable. Monday nights were the climax of the week when we sat up nearly till dawn getting the paper to the printers. In the dark, smoky city room of the news, amid the clatter of our old Underwood typewriters, we became a team of colleagues and friends. It was a bittersweet moment when I handed over the editorial duties at the spring dinner. I still had a year of college left, but I couldn't continue on the staff if I was to work full-time on the Worcester Gazette. Because I couldn't just quit writing cold turkey, I continued to do some articles and columns for the news during the final months of the year, under my Greek name, N.C. Nagioannis. One Monday, sitting in the news office, I read a view in the New York Times book section praising a new biography of playwright Eugene O'Neill by Barbara and Arthur Gelb. Because theater was one of my passions, I went to the university book store, where I discovered the book cost $12.50. So over a number of visits, I read it furtively, standing in the bookstore's aisle. Eventually, I came to a poignant scene from O'Neill's last days. His widow, Carlotta Monterey, related that when O'Neill realized he was dying, he decided to destroy all his unfinished plays so no one else would ever work on them. He had planned an 11-play cycle, but only one play was finished, and the depressed and ailing O'Neill insisted that Carlotta help him rip up the unfinished manuscripts and burn them in the fireplace of the Boston Hotel suite where they were living. It was awful. It was like tearing up children, Carlotta told the Gelbs, describing one of the most terrible acts of destruction in American literary history. Some months later, the book continued, O'Neill died at the age of 65, shortly after gasping, born in a hotel room, and damn it, died in a hotel room. As I stood in the aisle of the bookstore, lost in the biography, I realized that this scene had taken place on the campus of Boston University, for the Shelton Hotel, where O'Neill died, was now a university dorm, Shelton Hall. I decided to write a story for the news about this local angle, but when I convinced the house mother of Shelton Hall to take me up to Suite 401, I discovered that there was no fireplace. After knocking on all the walls and then tracking down the original blueprints in Boston Buildings Department, I learned that there never had been a fireplace. O'Neill couldn't have burned his plays there. Shortly after my piece describing what I had learned appeared in the BU News, it became the subject of a newspaper column by Elliot Norton, the famous drama critic. He cited my detective work and wondered if O'Neill's widow had perhaps lied to the Gelbs and still had the precious missing plays in her possession. The story hit the Associated Press wire and appeared all across the country. I received a frantic telephone call at the news office from the biography's co-author Arthur Gelb, who was then the chief cultural correspondent for the New York Times. The Times calling the BU News seemed as unlikely as the White House calling the president of our student body. I took the receiver nervously from the hand of an odd reporter and heard Gelb's intense, rapid-fire voice asking, what had I written? How had I learned it? What were my sources? How could this be true? He and his wife Barbara had checked every fact in the book's 970 pages, he insisted. Did you go to Shelton? I asked. Of course I went to Shelton, Gelb replied. But there was some problem about getting into the room. He assured me that he would question O'Neill's widow at once about the discrepancy and let me know what he found. In the meantime, I continued my own investigation. I tracked down the man who had been manager of the hotel before BU bought it, and he eventually led me to a woman who had been a maid in the hotel when the O'Neills lived there. She told me that she and Mrs. O'Neill and a hotel floorman, since deceased, had carried the torn manuscripts down to the basement and burned them there in the incinerator. Soon, Gelb called me back and said Carlotta O'Neill had given him the same story. He said he would revise the biography in its next edition and thanked me for catching the error. That was a nice piece of investigative reporting, he added. You should think about going into journalism. That's what I want to do, I told him. Well, if you ever get to New York, come and see me, Gelb concluded amiably. Maybe I can help. The following week, I received in the mail a copy of the biography, O'Neill, which had been inscribed to me by both authors, so that you won't have to read this standing up. Getting praise from the New York Times was heady stuff for a college junior, but I knew I had to work for a New York newspaper. I'd first have to get my college degree and some experience on a smaller paper. At the end of my junior year, I left normal college life behind to work full-time for the Evening Gazette and commute. That way, I hoped to save enough to pay for my final year and perhaps some left over for graduate school. Columbia's Graduate School of Journalism was the best in the country. I knew and a shortcut into New York's journalism. But for the time being, I could hardly pay for my last year of college, much less graduate school. I returned home to Chandler Street, where I received periodic letters from Dave Mulholland. His experiences working for the Peace Corps made my work for the Gazette seem less trivial by comparison. The previous Christmas, Mulholland had arrived at his post in the barrio called Ilog in the southern Philippines to teach in an overcrowded school where the students had to provide their own chairs. To get to school every day, he had to travel 3 miles, riding a bike through sugarcane fields and paddling a dugout canoe across a river. When a student failed to come to school and Dave asked why, the other children would usually reply, "Oh, he died," Dave wrote. Dave's tales of life in the Philippines reminded me how lucky I was, and I worked with redoubled energy at the Gazette. I was getting interesting assignments and searching the classified section to find a good used car. I was also encouraging Dino to buy his own restaurant. One summer day, he showed me a place called the Crossroads at the junction of two highways in West Boylston, a small restaurant with a counter, a few tables, and a location on the corner of a pretty village green. I said it looked like a good investment, and Dino decided to combine his savings with Angelo's and buy it. My life seemed all worked out when Steve Donahue told me one morning that I was being moved from the reporting staff to the county desk, where I would edit stories coming in from suburban bureaus. I don't want to be an editor working on other people's stories, I protested. I want to be a reporter. Sorry, Nick, you have to take it, Steve persisted. Those are A's, F's orders. A.F. Smith was the managing editor of the Gazette, a flamboyant, Sydney Greenstreet type who wore a Panama hat in summer and moved and spoke with a languid elegance rarely encountered in Worcester. I went to his office at once, but A.F. calmly and firmly told me I'd better transfer my things to the county desk. I lost all enthusiasm for my work as I spent every day brooding over the suburban copy, town meetings, debates over water rights and dump privileges, trying to inject some life into the stories. Every day as I got off the elevator, I would stop in AF's office and beg him to put me back on the reporting staff. Pretty soon he would wince every time he saw me. Finally, one day in August, he said in his well-modulated accent, "Nicholas, my boy, I'm afraid that life offers options, not ideals. Your options at this particular moment in time are to keep on doing what you're doing on the county desk or to leave the paper." "All right, then," I said in less modulated tones. "If those are my options, I quit." Suddenly, all my carefully laid plans dissolved like a soap bubble. I had no job, no way to pay for my last year of college, no positions on the BU News, and nowhere to live. In desperation, I approached every newspaper in and around Boston during the rest of the summer, but they all insisted on a college degree before they would hire me. I paid a sentimental visit to the BU News office, and on the way out ran into a woman who worked for the university's press office. She offered me a position at the press office of the School of Fine Arts, saying, "It doesn't pay much, but it might get you through." The job meant spending about 4 hours a day in a tiny office in the School of Fine Arts, writing press releases about events happening there, art exhibits, concerts, theater productions. It paid only $800 a year, but combined with a Wall Street Journal scholarship of $500 I'd won the previous year, I thought I might make it. I found a tiny apartment on Park Drive with a Murphy bed that folded into the wall and prepared to return to Boston. At the nadir of the summer, just after losing my job, I learned that my old colleague and friend, Dave Mulholland, had died of dysentery in the Philippines. He was the first member of the Peace Corps to lose his life in its service. His parents told me that on his last day, he was asking the doctors how soon he could return to Ilog, saying, "I have so much to do there." Once I was settled in Boston, I hitchhiked to Quincy to visit Dave's parents. They showed me a collection of his photographs and letters, including one to a Filipino friend in which he wrote, "Try to do one little thing that's immortal. Perhaps then everything will seem worthwhile." I wanted to write about Dave and contacted my old city editor at the Evening Gazette about doing the story. But he said, "It would never get printed if you wrote it. AF's still really pissed off at your leaving." I finally convinced Dave's hometown paper, the Quincy Patriot Ledger, to print it, and they devoted an entire page to Dave's life and work in the Philippines on December 21, 1962. Shortly after Christmas, I got a call from the dean of BU's journalism school asking me if he could submit the piece to a contest sponsored by the William Randolph Hearst Foundation. "We never win these things," the dean said to me, "but I liked your story on the Peace Corps guys so much, I thought we should submit it." A month or so later, by the time I'd forgotten the contest, I got another call saying that the story on Dave Mulholland had won me first place national award for the month, the sum of $750. I was several months behind in my rent, and I realized that the prize not only would save me from eviction, it would get me through the rest of the year. "What else have you got that we can submit?" the dean inquired. "What's the next category?" I asked. "Let's see," he muttered. "For March, the category is editorials." I sent him a sheaf of editorials I had written for the Hellenic Chronicle. The dean was as excited as I was when he called me back again 2 months later to announce that I had won 8th place in that month's competition, a prize of $100. Winning the Hearst Awards gave me the courage to do what several of my old friends from the BU News were doing, apply to Columbia's Graduate School of Journalism. It had a highly competitive program that accepted only 80 students a year out of some 800 applicants, and it provided working experience in New York and contacts on the big city newspapers. By the time I went home to Worcester that April to celebrate Greek Easter, I was in sorry shape. All of my friends had received letters of acceptance from Columbia, and I hadn't. Furthermore, when I got home, I learned that Dino and Angelo's restaurant was failing badly. "The place is eating up all our savings," Dino told me. The roasted lamb, the dill and entrail soup, and the sweet braided Easter bread studded with red eggs were as delectable as ever, evoking past Easters in the village when meat had been only a faint memory. But I couldn't really enjoy myself because I was worried about my brother-in-law's restaurant, the poor advice I'd given Dino, and my own problematic future. Then a letter arrived saying that Columbia had accepted me, and furthermore, awarded me a scholarship of $2,500. This was wonderful news, but I needed at least $3,500 to attend. I wrote back accepting, adding that I didn't yet have the full tuition, but was optimistic I could make the additional $1,000 I needed over the summer. Shortly after returning to school from Easter vacation, I was in my office in the School of Fine Arts one afternoon when I received a call from Karen Gaines, the press officer who had given me my job. "Are you sitting down, Nick?" she asked. With an instant vision of press releases gone wrong, I took a deep breath and said, "Let me have it." "You're going to the White House," Karen said. "If nominated, I will not run, and if elected, I will not serve," I replied. "No, seriously," she insisted. "You're the first place winner of this year's Hearst National Journalism Award, and President Kennedy is presenting it to you on May 14th. First, I was incredulous, then ecstatic. John F. Kennedy was a hero not just to Greek immigrants, but to college students, Peace Corps volunteers, professors, everyone I knew. As soon as Karen hung up, I dialed my father. "You'll never guess what happened," I shouted. "I'm going to the White House next month." "You mean they've given you a job at the White House?" he exclaimed. Somewhat deflated, I explained that no, it wasn't a job. It was an award for journalism that I would receive from the hands of President Kennedy. "Well, that's pretty good for a greenhorn who just got off the boat 14 years ago," he said cheerfully. "Is it going to be on television?" "I don't think so," I admitted, my ego definitely reduced to normal size by now. "But it'll be in the papers," I added consolingly. "Well, let's not tell anyone until we see if it really happens," he advised. "You know how these politicians can change their minds." My father evidently didn't follow his own advice, however, because the next time I returned home for a weekend, I was mobbed by Greeks on the church steps, all of them wanting a word along with me. Women and men were tugging at my sleeve, grasping my shoulder, hissing in my ear, "You know, my daughter's husband, the one who can't get a visa because he jumped ship once? Just a single word from you to Kennedy and I know our problems would be over. My brother's passport, my son's application to college, my mother's heart operation, my father's pension. All these matters would be instantly resolved if I could only whisper one word into the president's ear." I explained, at first patiently and then more irritably, that it would not be appropriate for me to request favors at the moment the President of the United States was presenting me with an award. It was a public ceremony, I said. We would not be alone together. There was no opportunity for such requests. Of course, I understand, they replied, winking and tapping a temple with a forefinger. After all, we are both men of the world, are we not? Naturally, you couldn't speak of such things while the president is conferring an award. But before the ceremony, or perhaps afterwards, just a discreet word from you as a friend to friend on the subject of my problems with the Internal Revenue Service. Well, I know it would be nothing to a man of importance like yourself. By the time the 300th person had come up with instructions for the Rusfetti that I must ask of the president on his behalf, I was no longer civil. Even my own relatives would not accept my statement that I couldn't carry petitions to Kennedy for them. My father had no personal boon he wanted me to demand of Kennedy. Instead, he counseled me on how to make polite conversation with the president. You tell Mr. Kennedy that the best customers on my vegetable route were the Irish, the cooks in the rich Yankee houses, he advised. When the day came to fly to Washington, I went alone. I put on my one well-worn blue suit, white shirt, and narrow all-purpose tie, put another shirt and a change of underwear in a school satchel, and took the MTA and a bus to Logan Airport. I had never been on an airplane before, but I was so excited that it never occurred to me to be afraid. I was going to the White House to meet the president. God wouldn't let the plane crash now. The Hearst Foundation had mailed me the plane ticket and the directions to the Mayflower Hotel, where the winners of the Hearst contest would be welcomed at a cocktail party. When I entered the hotel, I discovered that the two other winners to be cited by the president were from the University of Nebraska and had come with an entourage, while I knew no one. There were also many prestigious newsmen and women and several members of the Hearst family, including Randolph Hearst. The next morning, we were escorted on a brief tour of the city and then to the Capitol, where we were honored at a luncheon hosted by our respective senators. Mine was Edward M. Kennedy. That afternoon at the White House, as our credentials were checked and we were waved through the gates, I was overcome by the sense of being in a movie instead of real life, a feeling that recurred often before I got back home. We were ushered into a richly decorated waiting room and then joined by Kenneth O'Donnell, the president's director of appointments. Finally, he said, "The president is ready to see you now," and led us into the Oval Office. You have been listening to Backyard Bookshelf, a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Naomi. Thank you for listening.
People with disabilities adapt on a daily basis. They're people you want on your team. And at the Mass Commission for the Blind, we're here to help you find blind and visually impaired professionals to help you reach your organizational goals. Call 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB to learn how you can become an employer partner for the blindness community. That's 1-800-392-6450. Or visit mass.gov/MCB.